Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to take a look at the Danish cohort study that all the world is using to justify a pro-vaccine and an attack against those who question vaccines. The New York Times and Yahoo, all the ones that allowed this to go out without any criticism, hold a responsibility to look for the truth. They have abrogated that. We still find the truth important, and we will be challenging and rebutting and deconstructing the study to show you it is junk, worthless. Shame on the media for causing all this nonsense when there was nothing there. It was Gertrude Stein who said there's no there. There's just nothing there. But on the other side, there's a lot there. Because at the same time that we're deconstructing that, we're also going to have a Dr. Meryl Nass, medical doctor, board certified, on to talk about childhood vaccines that are unjustifiably mandated. So we'll share the good science supporting why you should challenge the mandated vaccines and the bad science we will deconstruct today, showing you what's wrong with all this false or faux uproar about those parents, scientists, physicians, activists, and journalists who are questioning, possibly for the first time, vaccine safety. We are going to be writing an article, a very important article. I never know who's listening, but a lot of people do from different walks of life. If you are a person in the medical field, if you're a physician, for example, or a nurse, and you have had vaccine-damaged children or a child, we'd like to hear from you. We'd like to include your story in our article. You can reach us by going to prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com. And if you can't get through there, we do have a voicemail, and you can leave a message on our voicemail, and we'll be called back. Our voicemail is 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. And we are getting some interesting people who either live in Puerto Rico or are from Puerto Rico who want to be a part of this health study that we're doing in Puerto Rico. And so you can also send information to us or call and leave your information at 646-926-5422, our main office number. I have a guest today, very interesting guest. This will be a conversation with a remarkable mind guest. Time for coastal residents to start retreating from the ocean. The threat of the sea level rise is irreversible. In other words, no seawall is going to protect you. Now, we're talking about 65 million Americans. We're talking about probably $2 trillion minimally in real estate devaluation. But Professor Oren Pilkey, Professor Emeritus of Earth Sciences at Duke University and the founding director emeritus of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at the university's Nicholas School of the Environment, where he has been teaching for over 54 years. He is recognized as probably the world's leading expert in coastal geology, in barrier islands, and ocean levels, and beach loss, and replenishment. And so he's the heavyweight. He's published over 250 technical publications and peer-reviewed journals, and he is the author of Retreat from the Rising Sea, Hard Choices in the Age of Climate Change, as well as Lessons from the Sand and The Last Beach. And the former Secretary of the Interior, Bruce Babbitt, called his book, The Rising Sea, a must-read for all Americans. So he's going to be the guest, and then later today I'll be filming him down at Duke University. So that's a really eye-opening original. Also today, we will be continuing to discuss socialism, but unfortunately, I fully understand and appreciate people's concerns that they want to see more equality, they want to see less greed, they want to see that those in positions of power understand the needs of those who have no power. But then there's a difference of understanding the problem and the solution from a very practical and as well as pragmatic point of view. How do you actually achieve this? So we're going to have that discussion as well. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. Avocado seed, what most people throw away or use to start another avocado plant, well, the avocado seed has chemicals in it that show promise as anti-inflammatory compounds. This was done at Penn State University, and it's strongly anti-inflammatory, and it represents a potential source of anti-inflammatory nutrients that are part of functional food, meaning the food actually functions in a good way in the body. And the researchers developed the extract over the last 10 years as a food colorant, and it's now being tested to turn off all kinds of pain in your body. That's a good thing. Rice University study highlights the dangers of being deficient in vitamin B12. They find that there's a direct link between B12 deficient and increased risk of infections. So for all of the vegans who may not know how to balance your diet to get enough B12, I suggest be very easy. Go for a 50 milligram B-complex, and within that you're generally going to get 500 micrograms of B12, or you can take a supplement of 1 milligram of methylated B12 each day, and that will do it. Because if not, then you're going to end up with all forms of toxic byproducts in your body and damaging your mitochondrial health, the actual mitochondria that give your body cells their energy. So you need B12. And a lot of people who suffer from depression or fatigue or sleep long hours, and when they get tested, the doctor says, we can't find anything wrong with you, it must be psychological. No, frequently it's B12 deficiency. Because I've seen people when they re-stimulate the biochemistry with B12, they perk right back up. From Ludwig Institute for Cancer Research in Germany, published in Cell Stem Cell, the NAD, the nicotinamide riboside, is now being used to treat leukemia and lymphoma. And that's important. This was discovered by a team of researchers. It's a form of B3, and it can increase the production of a stem cells, which are the precursors of various blood cells in the body. And these stem cells are now used in the treatment of leukemia and lymphoma in a process by which cancerous blood stem cells are removed and replaced with healthy cells. So that's something new. And I'm seeing more and more really outstanding research showing what stem cells can do. And there's even one for men who have Peyronie's disease. That's where their sexual organ turns back and is curved. And it's a really interesting therapy. And most people have never heard of it, but it's relatively simple. It's called the P-shot, PRP, or it's an injection, a Priapus injection. They take your blood, they spin it down, take the serum, and they re-inject directly in about 10 or 12 places, and this rebuilds the cells. Remarkable work with some outstanding results. I'll do more on that. I just interviewed a physician who was using it on patients, and this was in a casual conversation. This came up, and I said, that would make an interesting topic for radio audience because it's something some men have, never talk about it, and other men who they have damage to the blood vessels. And by the way, bike riders in particular are very susceptible to this because they're sitting on those stupid little seats on my bikes. I go get the biggest, softest, cushiony, and then I put another cushion on top of that because I see no reason to be. What you're doing is you're just compressing all of the blood vessels going into the reproductive region, and that's bad for a person, and that frequently causes those blood vessels to be damaged. In return, the person ends up not being able to have a full erection, maybe a partial erection. So there's now ways that you can break up those cellular debris and damaged tissue, and the body can remove that and lay down new blood tissue. So just some things that are going on in the world of stem cell research, and I'll do more on it on upcoming programs. And then you have Kava. That's K-A-V-A. Kava Kava is called. And it's from the Pacific Islands. And there was a study from Grand Valley State University in Michigan that found that by taking Kava, you can substantially relax. It's an anti-anxiety herb. And they used it in a study for less than 8 weeks. And it makes a big difference. And by the way, if you wonder how bad it is, the World Health Organization estimates that 1 in 14 people around the world has an anxiety disorder. That's a lot of anxiety. And with anxiety, you end up not being able to function in relationships in a healthy way. But they did a double-blind study. They did two trials, and both showed anti-anxiety outcomes. So that's good. And also from Georgia State University comes a study on early life exposure to the microbiota. And if you have good bacteria in your intestines when you're young, you help restrict colon cancer later in life. It's that simple. Now, there was a time when most kids in America had a healthy breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And all that changed in the mid-70s. And a little before, and then came forward. Now it's just epidemic. This was published in the journal Cancer Immunology Research. So, clean the gut, detoxify the body, put in new healthy bacteria, and you can help prevent colon cancer as you get older. And finally, stress hormones promote breast cancer metastasis. This is from the University of Basel in Switzerland. And it's long been thought that stress contributes to cancer progression. Scientists from the university, as well as the university hospital, have deciphered the molecular mechanisms linking breast cancer metastasis spreading with increased stress hormones, like cortisol. In addition, they found that synthetic derivatives of stress hormones, which are frequently used as an anti-inflammatory in cancer therapy, decrease the efficacy of the chemotherapy. And these results come from patient-derived models of breast cancer. And this was published in the journal Nature. So the takeaway message is this. We're not going to be able to eliminate stress. Stress is a normal part of our lives. When I interviewed the father of stress psychology and medicine, Dr. Hans Selye, over 45 years ago on my radio show, and subsequently many times, and we communicated, he said, well, there's really two types of stress. There's distress, which is destructive. And if it's temporary, you can overcome it. If it's chronic, where you're chronically insecure, so no matter what you achieve, where the object is, I'm going to finally get this and be secure. This relationship is what I need to be secure about my emotions and self. I don't want to grow old alone, so I better have a relationship now because who's going to want me later? I don't want to be left in that insecure place. So insecurity is a major promoter of chronic, meaning constant stress. Even if we can function to the world outside, it's what's going on inside. That distress, according to Hans Selye, is what causes us to die prematurely, to have more strokes and heart attacks, and now cancer. This university study in Switzerland confirms that. So, then the other side of that is also true. By being mindful, not personalizing everything, then yes, you'll have stress, but you're not bringing that stress into your mind, into your heart, into your emotions, into your choices. You're simply saying, okay, I have a problem to deal with. Let me deal with this problem without becoming the problem. So by looking at something that's stressful or a problem, you can also take a step back and saying, I'm going to look at this of how I can solve it, but I'm not going to acknowledge it by being a part of it. That's an important differentiation. I'll give one more, and that is, we never look at the inactive ingredients in pills. Well, MIT, as well as Brigham and Women's Hospital, did. And they found there's a lot of different peanut oil, gluten, chemical dyes, lactose, which is milk sugar, that are used as these inexpensive ingredients. They're not inert. They can cause allergic reactions in the body. So always look at all the ingredients, not just the active ingredients, but the inactive ingredients. Because almost 45% of all medications contain lactose, and almost 33% of all medications contain food dye. And so we don't want anything that we're taking in that could be causing us to end up having a problem. So just read the ingredients, make sure they're done right. We're going to take a quick break, come back and take... I'm on a tight schedule, so I'm only going to take one call today.
Hi, Gary. This is Rochelle, 43-year listener. And my question is, what's the status with manufacturing madness?
Rochelle, manufacturing madness is a project I began over 12 years ago. First, on any project, you have to do your research and then take an honest, objective look at the data and say, what does it support? What positions does it support? That took about a year because we had to read literally 4,000 or 5,000 articles, probably 100 books. Then the second part was the human or clinical part, interviewing people who had used the different treatment modalities that are recommended for depression, bipolar, etc., and see what was the long-term outcome. And we generally used 2 years as a minimum that a person was under treatment, and then what were their diagnoses. And almost every diagnosis was brain chemical imbalance, manifesting as, and then listing it. We then had to look at all the different ingredients that were in the medications. We had to study the history of those medications to see how they got it passed. So all this was done and all this has been done. Then I had to find the people I wanted to film. And we have filmed some. I have not finished the film. I probably have another 6 months. But 7 years ago, the environmental film took precedent. And that's what we're finishing. That's what I'm filming today at 2 o'clock at Duke University. And just up in Canada, filming. One of the leading environmentalists in the world, and just confirmed that there's a person living in Australia, 4-hour drive from Sydney, and there's no other way to get there. You just got to drive for 4 hours out, do a 45-minute film, and 4 hours back, go to the airport and fly 17 hours back or 19 hours back. That's what it takes. But if you want to have the best people around the world talking on a topic and have that be a meaningful film, that's what happens. So we're right at the very end of our environmental film. We're within 2 weeks of finishing it. And then we finish our post-production, and then I'll plan a screening sometime this summer. Immediately after that film is completed, I will complete Manufacturing Madness. All the important people in the film who are board-certified psychiatrists, and you'll see 12... I'll tell you one thing you will see in the film. You'll see 12 board-certified psychiatrists, all highly respected, several are professors, who within anywhere from 2 minutes and 42 seconds to 7 minutes of seeing a stranger for the first time, diagnosed them with a condition and gave them a prescription for some form of medication. When they were met on the street afterwards and said, this is a completely normal, healthy woman who's a medical doctor, nothing at all wrong, then what was the basis of giving a diagnosis and a treatment schedule. Well, it's all subjective, they would say. Do you acknowledge there is no such thing as a brain chemical imbalance? Oh, yeah, everyone knows that. Every single psychiatrist said that. So then why are you having people believe that they have a depression that is biochemical or an anxiety that is biochemical or bipolar that doesn't exist? And then they squirm. This is what happens when one group in a society becomes codified as legitimate when it isn't. That much we have on film. We have a lot on film. And we have victims of a lot of the therapies. That's it on that. Now, I'm going to share some insights from Dr. Brian Hooker, a professor out in California. And this is a scientist's rebuttal to the Danish cohort study. The MMR vaccine study, that I'm sure you're all familiar with now, recently published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and it was entitled Measles, Mumps, and Rubella Vaccine in Autism, a Nationwide Cohort Study. First of all, it leaves many more serious questions than definitive answers. And the authors claim that their work, quote, strongly supports that the MMR vaccination does not increase the risk for autism, but does not trigger autism in susceptible children and is not associated with clustering of autism cases after a vaccination, end quote. That's a very powerful statement to make. So they gave it a complete bill of health, and everybody ran with that. All the pro-vaccine people had what they wanted, something they could use in propaganda. But was it true? Let's go through it and show what happens when you can actually understand the vaccine science. And Dr. Brian Hooker does. His son is a teenager and is diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, and it was from vaccine injury. One. Children were notably missing from the study sample. That's a big red flag. First and foremost is the short number of autism cases within the data sample. The study authors used Denmark population registries of children born in Denmark of Danish-born mothers who should reflect the current reported autism incidence in Denmark at 1.65%. That's according to the Journal of the American Medical Association. However, the autism incidence within the sample that they used is 0.98%, meaning that approximately 4,400 autistic children are missing from this study. That's another big flag. The authors did not discuss the discrepancy in the number of cases. Why not? In and of itself, that would have disqualified the study. The American media didn't question it. American science reporters didn't question it. Number two, many of the children in the sample were too young for an autistic diagnosis. The most probable reason for the discrepancy in cases is that the sample in their study, in the paper, well, the people are just too young to completely ascertain autism diagnosis. The average age of sample is 8 years in 8.64 years with a standard deviation of 3.48 years. Age of autism diagnosis on average is 7.22 years with a standard deviation of 2.86 years. Now, assuming that the age of diagnosis follows a standard bell curve, this would mean that 31.5% of the sample was too young to get an autism diagnosis. And this could account for as many as 3,400 additional cases not included in the analysis, which would bias the outcomes in favor of not finding a relationship between the MMR vaccine and autism. Now, the question is, how could such an obvious, glaring, blatant error in design and outcome not have been challenged? What legitimate statistician, medical statistician, biostatistician, physician? I mean, one of my college students would have picked this up in research methodology class. Number three, failure to eliminate those with autism related to genetic conditions from the sample. What do I mean? In addition, individuals who were diagnosed with genetic autism known to lead to autism, after age one were censored, meaning they were followed until the time of diagnosis but not removed from the study. Thus, they were counted among the sample, with many of them most likely autistic due to a genetic condition having nothing to do with the vaccine. These should have appropriately been eliminated from the sample. Remember, they were sampling against the MMR vaccine, but these individuals are known to have a genetic comorbidity that leads to autism, and they were, quote, censored. That completely biased the study and skewed the numbers. Number four, the use of two different MMR vaccines. Two different MMR vaccines were used in this study. The GlaxoSmithKline Prolix formulation was used from 2000-2007, and Merck's MMR2 formulation was used from 2008-2013. Prolix contains the Schwartz measles strain, and the MMR2 contains the Endemustin measles strain. Thus, children using the Merck formula were much too young to receive an autism diagnosis, as the oldest they would be at the time of the study is 6 years of age or younger. This is important for comparison to the experience in other countries, especially the United States, where the Merck formulation was used exclusively for the entire study period. You can't have two different drugs, even if they're called the MMR vaccine, because they're different strains, because each strain is going to have a different outcome. Number five, the failure to control for the dosage effects. In addition, the age at which Danish children in the sample received their second dose of the MMR vaccine was dropped from 12 years to 4 years in 2008. This means that children born after 2004 will get two MMR vaccines prior to the average age of an autism diagnosis, where children born prior to 2004 would have received only one MMR vaccine. If indeed there is a dosage effect of the MMR where both doses were causally related to autism, this could not be elucidated in the sample. And again, this would bias the results enormously and egregiously to not find a relationship. Number six, statistical method failure to capture those children with a delayed diagnosis of autism. The authors also used a non-transparent statistical method where person years was considered following the MMR vaccine in an autism diagnosis, where children who received a diagnosis soon after receiving their first MMR vaccine would be weighed more heavily than children with a delayed diagnosis. This makes no sense given that the age of autism diagnosis varies widely among populations based upon access to the services and severity of the autism case, among other factors. This type of method is borrowed from infectious disease epidemiology, where an exposure directly leads to a disease state rather quickly, for example, chickenpox. However, the method has no place in evaluating chronic sequelae to vaccination, which may take a period of years to receive an accurate diagnosis. And the last two, number seven, vaccinated male siblings of children with autism showed more autism diagnosis. It's interesting to note that the increased incidence of autism in boys with autistic siblings in the vaccinated group show in their charts. The increase towards the end of the survival curve shows that more boys vaccinated with MMR vaccine with autistic siblings are diagnosed with autism than boys that are unvaccinated. The difference is not statistically significant, but this may be an artifact of the very small subset of boys considered in the analysis. And finally, number eight, there are conflicts of interest in the study authors. It should be noted that three of the study authors are currently employed by the Staten Serum Institute, which is a for-profit vaccine manufacturer in Denmark. In addition, this work was funded by a grant from the Novo Nordisk Foundation, and Novo Nordisk is a Danish multinational pharmaceutical manufacturer. These are serious conflicts of interest. And the lead author, Andrew Havid, was the second author of the New England Journal of Medicine MMR Autism paper in 2002. This research was completed despite the fact that the study authors had never received proper ethics approval to complete the study. So with these issues, this paper cannot be relied upon as evidence of the MMR vaccine not causing autism. It is junk science. And all these red flags, and no one in the media, no one in science, no one in the FDA and CDC challenged it. We're the first people to challenge this. I just want to show you how much nonsense goes on. I'll save my comments for tomorrow from Meryl Nass on all the childhood vaccines that have no justifiable reason whatsoever for being mandated outside of profit. We'll deal with that tomorrow. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to go to our guest in about 8 or 9 minutes from now. Now let's go in and say hello to Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary.
Richard, we began to talk yesterday about meritocracy, and I was going to lead it into socialism, but we didn't get there. So let's begin by, why don't you give us an understanding, the real understanding and history of socialism and how it's frequently mislabeled today. And as a result, by many on the right, and even on the left now, on MSNBC and CNN, they're attacking Venezuela and Maduro for being socialist, and they're only showing selectively edited and selective interviews of people who want Maduro, the democratically elected president, gone, so that the right-wing people will get back in power. That's all misread. That's not what socialism is. So, and hello, a wake-up call to all those on the left who are using Ms. Cortez's example of Venezuela is socialist. It is not a socialist country, contrary to all the nonsense. So take us on a short historical understanding of socialism.
Yeah, that's correct, Gary. And just to phrase one thing is that what I've discovered is some of the largest critics of Maduro, and even during Chavez, when Hugo Chavez was in office, was coming from the Socialist Labor Party, labor group, worker groups in Venezuela. They were the ones some of the biggest critics of Chavez as not being a socialist country. But before that, what we find in the media, and particularly from the alt-right, is this confusion between communism and socialism. They've made these words interchangeable. Trump kind of repeated that as well. But there are very fundamental differences between these. I mean, when we're speaking of communism, we're speaking about a working class that basically owns everything, and that everyone works towards the same communal goal. And there's no division whatsoever between the wealthy and poor. All are equal. And the community distributes what it produces based upon need. And the consequence of that, which we've seen, you can see in Cuba, I'll ask you to speak about Cuba because you've been there, but with early Maoist China, Soviet Union, North Korea, has been very low production and poverty, and there's really no incentive for advancement. But socialism, on the other hand, although it's focused on equality, but the workers earn wages and they can do what they want. The one thing is that it's government controls the natural resources, not the government or private interests, as in the case of the United States. And so the government's not, it operates the production of products. So the difference is that individuals' earnings are based on their contribution that they give. If you work harder in advance, you will receive more. So it's like capitalism in that sense. But unlike communism, there still is a class distinction that exists in the socialist system, but it's less so. It doesn't have this kind of extreme of the rich and the poor as you find in capitalist societies. And the other thing is the socialism is strictly an economic philosophy, whereas communism is an economic and political philosophy. And I think that's another important difference to make, because we can look at Canada and Norway and Scandinavian countries and France and the UK, and there are strong elements of socialism, just as we have here with Social Security, with Medicare, Medicaid, our police force, law enforcement, fire departments. These are all socialist programs, and of course we have corporate socialism as well. But you can speak about your experiences in Cuba as being a more truly a communist country rather than a purely socialist.
It is, and they keep saying that Cuba is a good example of socialism. It is not. I was there, and unlike a lot of the people who I knew who went down there and worked in their, you know, sugarcane fields, I had the advantage of staying with the regular population, and I saw how they lived. I saw the suffering. I saw the frustration in young people who didn't want to be, in effect, indentured by the state to have no opportunities. They couldn't leave the country, and they had no money to survive within the country. So the government would give you free health care. But when Michael Moore did his film Sicko and showed that wonderful hospital and how clean everything was, my guide, who was the top surgeon of the hospital, and they take these gigs driving people because that's where they make some U.S. dollars, said, go any place in Cuba and ask people what they think of the hospital systems here, and they're a mess. You have to have enough money to buy your own medicines. They frequently have no medicines, and they're run down. And I drove from one end of Cuba to the other, the entire, and Cuba's big. You could put Cuba over California and you wouldn't see California. That's how big it is. Lush and beautiful it is. But when you're driving, you notice all the roads have potholes and all the buildings are just, they look like a bomb hit them. And you'll see people by the thousands sitting by the road with little gallon buckets with mangoes or bananas or watermelon or papaya for quarter. You can buy a whole bucket of it. And then you see how corrupt they are, that the elite, and this was true in Russia with 3 million top members of the Politburo. It's true in China, and true in Iran, and true in Turkey, true in every country in the world, that those at the top don't live by the same standards or rules as the rest who live at the bottom. And in this communism, everyone's phones were tapped. You had informants in every single school. In fact, I was told, don't stay at any of the hotels because every phone is tapped, and you'll see a person that you think is a cleaning person in the hall. They're not. They're there to monitor your comings and going. If you come back with a woman, you'll be raided, and they'll go to arrest the young lady, not yourself, and then they'll ask for cash, and you'll give them $150. Then the lady is no longer arrested, and then the lady splits up money with the cops. Everything is a scam or a scheme because people are so frustrated with the corruption, complete corruption, and of the rule in Cuba. And so private entrepreneurship is discouraged. They're now loosening up a little bit, so a few restaurants have opened up. But they have a dysfunctional relationship with the capitalist system. So that's that, and I have a lot more to say about Cuba, but that's at least the Cuban people I thought were tremendous. I just had no respect for the way they're governed. But understand something. Capitalism has many different connotations. If we do not have ethical capitalism, which we've had at different times in our society, then you end up going to the other extreme, which is vulture capitalism, where people do not care about the needs of other people, nor the loss of resources, nor what are we building homes in areas that a person should not be living in. Right now, if you went to Miami Beach or South Beach, where I lived for 16 years, you would see new buildings going up. You'll see more and more higher-priced apartments. Once, 10 years ago, they were $600,000. Now they're $2 million. And so you have to ask yourself, do these people not know about the encroachment of the water? Yeah, they probably know, but no one wants to believe that it's going to happen. Everybody believes that that day will not come, and that's the part of capitalism that exploits people's utopian beliefs or their fears. They get you on both sides. So if we had an Eisenhower form of capitalism, you would also have an Eisenhower form of socialism. If you go back and you look at what Eisenhower actually stood for, and you saw the messages he gave us, you would say, wow, he's very progressive on a lot of issues. And he actually was. Not all, but on many. And what we have today is pure, unbridled, mercenary capitalism. So then you say, well, we can't be socialists and be capitalists. We have always had some form of social effort, our fire departments, our public schools, our libraries, our Coast Guard, emergency crews, the National Guard, our armies and air forces. These are all there to serve the people. Now, how they've been misused is a separate issue. But in countries that do not have a standing army, a large standing army, and a 53 to 56% of all their money goes to the military-industrial complex, and they have money for public education and quality education in Sweden and Finland and Denmark and Norway. Yes, one of the best educational systems in the world. And they have money for universal health care, and they have money for public roads and building maintenances and infrastructure repairs and expansion. But they also have some of the highest taxes. Well, most people would say, I'll pay higher taxes, a surcharge or value-added tax of 20%, if I also know that a lot of my needs are going to be taken care of if I need that. And they have collectively, as a group, decided that that's a system. But you couldn't have that kind of social effort or social safety net if you didn't have a very large free market system. And they have a lot of ethical small corporations that pay taxes, don't complain about the taxes. People don't complain about the tax because they get so much benefit from it. We complain about the taxes, no small measure, because of how mismanaged and misused our taxes go to subsidize major industries that exploit us and bail out the banking system and bail out General Motors. But we won't bail out a small business person. We won't bail out a homeowner. So you see, we've misinterpreted what real socialism is versus the kind of socialism that we've always had, except the worst type of socialism we have in America is bailing out corporations. We have corporate socialism that is embraced but never discussed. But immediately the person working for that major corporation that you've just bailed out and saved them from insolvency, they'll be the first person to say, but we should be cutting back on these social gratuities that we give people. Well, what about yours? What about the $21 trillion the Federal Reserve gave to you through quantitative easing? Why don't you stop taking money to cover your losses because you never share the money that were your profits? You see, until we understand the terms and how they're used and look at the interrelation of this picture, we will be divided by the lexus of terms that most people do not understand. Richard, thank you for being on.
You're welcome, Gary.
We're going right over to our guest. I was just notified he's on the air now. I've given you his bio a little earlier, and we're very pleased to have him here to speak on a very important topic. Sir, welcome, Dr. Oren Pilkey. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'd like you to begin by clarifying numbers we hear about rising sea levels because of the enormous range of studies and institutions predicting. Some are very conservative and say we have 100 years, so we're all going to be dead, so why care? Industries that say it's too expensive to make any changes, developers saying we can keep building by oceans because the big one's not going to come and the ocean's not going to rise, so you could go ahead and buy property, develop property, whether it's a mall or an apartment, and you'll live your life and your grandchildren will live their lives and you'll all be dead before anything happens. And others say we have less time, but no one, I believe, has been completely honest about the variabilities and what we really have in the way of time, and also the fact that we're all in chaos theory. No one has an absolutely accurate prediction of when some of these major weather events will occur. The variability of storm surges makes it difficult to predict sea levels rise with any precision. The Arctic and Greenland are melting much faster than previously thought, and the Antarctic ice sheets are faster at breaking up than anyone had predicted, larger chunks. So what are the most reliable estimates we can expect for rising ocean levels, let's say within the next 20 years or so?
Well, the next 20 years could be it could be as much as a foot, though that would be a high estimate probably. Of course, it's going to vary all over the world because not only is the sea rising, but the land is sinking, or in some cases is even rising. So, but it'll be maybe a maximum of a foot within 20 years, possibly. I would think it would be less than that. We tend to deal with what it's going to be in 100 years because we can be a bit more accurate there. I mean, there's so many variables. The warming ocean is right now is primarily responsible for the sea level rise that we have. But the melting of the Antarctic and Greenland, as you mentioned, that's going to take over the warming of the ocean. And all hell is going to break loose, I think.
Explain to people what it means when it may rise a certain amount of inches or a foot, but that's not the worst of it. And that's not what can cause some of the greatest damage. Could you go through what it means if you live on a coastal area such as Miami and up through all of Florida and into the Carolinas? What is actually happening, and why is it that the governments in those states are not suggesting that people be relocated in a timely and reasonable manner?
You know, your suggestion is certainly a good one, because if we can respond now, we can do it in a reasonable and planned fashion. If we don't respond now, within maybe 30 to 50 years, we will be responding in terms of catastrophes, of storms, not only is sea level rising, but the warming ocean is creating heavier, bigger storms with more rain. And when you put together the sea level rise and the more intense storms, we really should be moving back from a lot of shorelines now. Now, 1 foot sea level rise on many of our barrier islands and in many communities in Florida will create a lot of damage. The slopes of the land there are very, very, very gentle, very, very gentle slopes. And so a foot sea level rise can do a lot, not to mention the fact that the storm surges will be a lot higher because of the already raised sea level.
When I lived in South Beach for 16 years, and I moved 7 years ago, I saw on Alton Road, which is the road, there's two roads, on the ocean, Atlantic side, it's Ocean Drive, and on the other side, on the bay side, it's Alton Road. It was flooding every single night, about 16 inches of water every single night. So they came in and they spent hundreds of millions of dollars to build turbines to take that flooding and put it right back into the bay. That it then went right around the bottom of the island and became part of the ocean again. So it didn't resolve a single issue. It just meant that you wouldn't have flooding at that moment. But that was without all this rise. So we're getting larger, much, much more devastating tidal surges at night, even without any storms.
That's right. And then we have what we call king tides, which occur 3 or 4 times a year. And they're different in different places. But basically, this occurs when it's a spring tide, but it's when the moon is closest to the earth. And it produces a tide, like in Norfolk, Virginia, is 2 feet higher than the normal highest high tide. And so they can be very devastating. And king tides are what are really getting the attention of a lot of people in coastal communities, especially in Florida. One of the things they've done in Miami, they're starting to do, is to raise the roads. But the problem with raising the roads is that acts like a dam. When you have overwash, the road is higher, and it'll cause it will be a dam. And we've seen this happen in behind the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where in an area which really is not very developed, so it doesn't really matter that much, but we raised some of the roads to keep them out of the swamps. And it turns out when they do have a storm surge, there's a lot more flooding in places that normally would not have been flooded. So it's very difficult. And the only thing really in my view is to move or to raise the buildings in South Beach. But eventually we're going to have to move. There's just no way around it.
Explain the problems we're having with sand. I watched every morning when I go out at early before sunrise where barges would bring in tons of sand and bulldozers would smooth it up and down the beach. And when I would ask one of the people, what are you doing? They said, well, this is all washed away at night, so we have to bring it back in the morning. And I said, where are you getting this? He said, well, you used to get it nearby, and we now are having to go down to the Bahamas because there's just no more sand available. And I'm thinking, wow, that's an interesting story. What's happening with sand? And, of course, sand is being used for concrete making, and concrete making is one of the biggest environmental problems we have in the world. Could you please tell us more about sand, our beaches, and what's the outcome of that?
Yeah, you know, sand is nationwide, worldwide, is becoming very rare, very hard to get a hold of at a reasonable price and at a reasonable volume. So we have a whole new problem coming up in the future of construction everywhere in the world. The sand that you see coming on the beaches is from the continental shelf, but that is also a limited supply. It depends on where you are. Some places have a lot more sand than others, but in every case, in terms of the long term, it is a short. We're going to run out of sand even on the continental shelf. In order to nourish the beaches, you have to have millions of cubic yards, millions of cubic yards per mile. And that's a lot of sand, a lot of dump trucks of sand, a lot of dredged sand. So that's the problem. That's a big problem around the corner, just around the corner.
Well, we've already turned the corner when you look at Singapore's exploitation of Cambodia by dredging sand from the mangrove forest that is destroying an entire ecosystem so Singapore can continue with its construction unabated. And Dubai has virtually depleted all of its sand for concrete in its orgy of building construction and has to now import sand. And we are still witnessing right now enormous construction going on in Florida. And nobody speaks about the immense carbon footprint left by concrete industry. So what is your assessment of America's beaches in areas that are the most vulnerable to sea level rise?
Well, the most vulnerable of all of our states is by an order of magnitude is Florida. Florida is very low elevation, and the land adjacent to the shoreline is sloping very, very much. And so some cities not only Miami and Fort Lauderdale, they have another problem. They're on top of a very porous limestone where the water is just going to flow right in. But some cities like St. Pete and Tampa, St. Pete, those cities are just waiting for the bad storm. They're waiting for a storm that already occurred in the 1840s before people were living there. And in Singapore, I certainly agree with you that what's going on in Singapore is something of an atrocity. They're taking sand from Vietnam, from Cambodia, from Indonesia, and much of the sand is basically stolen. People get a barge full of sand and drive up to Singapore, and Singapore doesn't ask questions and pays for the sand. And Singapore is trying to expand by 20%. And they're expanding at the future of much of Southeast Asia, the future of the beach tourism and things like that that are so critical for the future. It's very difficult to sympathize with Singapore, to put it mildly.
My final question involves both Florida and New York. Florida was hit with 2 Category 4, but almost Category 5, just 2 miles an hour or less in Category 5 in the last 14 months. What would happen if Miami got hit by a Category 5 or New York got hit by a Category 5, which is highly probable in the near future? What would it look like?
It is highly probable. I think New York, I'm impressed that New York is starting to take some measures, building what they call the Big U around the city. And it may help reduce the storm surge, but it sure won't stop it. And I think the hurricane that hit a while back, Sandy, has helped considerably, because they've done things like they've moved their generators up from the first floor to the, you know, to the 17th floor or something like that. They've done a lot of things that'll help the city kind of make it more stormproof, not stormproof, but more resistant. Most other cities have not done that. And some cities like Miami, oh man, I really worry about that. And I really worry about the nuclear power plant right next to Miami, that is so low. And I think there's, and it's just, well, at any rate, I think that the real problems, the biggest problems are still in Florida and will be that way for years to come.
I would agree, but I would also consider New Orleans and Houston very problematic, not to mention smaller communities built on barrier islands, such as in Alabama, or off the coast of North and South Carolina. I believe they're also going to be facing a reality check in the near future.
Oh, yes. You know, the NOAA has said that the biggest area where millions of people are involved are, one, the Mississippi Delta, two, the South Florida, and three, the Inner Banks in northeastern North Carolina, which are very, very large area that's very low, but not many people, maybe a couple hundred thousand. So they don't really don't rank with Miami or the Mississippi Delta.
Well, let's hope that reasonable and responsible people realize that you don't have to have a Category 5 to have surging, which then destabilizes the buildings that are built on sand and not on hard stone, and that yeah. creates a process that over time weakens the stanchions that the whole building is supported by, and dams and levees and walls are not going to protect us from the destruction of these major cities in the future. I wish
understood
that.
You're absolutely right. And my final message that I always like to leave with is we should do something now. We should respond now and not wait until we have a catastrophe and then respond.
I couldn't agree with you more. Professor, thank you very much for being on. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And this is Professor Orrin, O-R-R-I-N, Pilkey, P-I-L-K-E-Y, and he is the Professor Emeritus of Earth Sciences at Duke University and Founding Director Emeritus of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at the University's Nicholas School of the Environment. And he is also the author of Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change. He also is the author of Lessons from the Sand and The Last Beach. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Hello, baby. How've you been? You sure look good.